This is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, 91.3 KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, June 24th, 2019. Ahead this hour, Becca Martin Brown with the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette explains how photographs exhibited at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum can move, literally move. She'll join us in our second half hour. After today's Ozarks on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR, a series of conversations with 2020 presidential candidates continues with Colorado Senator Democrat Michael Bennett. That's on Here and Now, beginning at 1 on 91.3. And if you're interested in discussing ways to make Fayetteville more bike-friendly, you'll likely meet like-minded folks tonight at Fossil Cove Brewing Company in Fayetteville. From 6 to 8 tonight, the biking abilities in Fayetteville will be part of the topic of conversation at Fossil Cove and co-hosted by Bike NWA. This is a cloudy Monday Ozarks at Large. Thanks for being with us. Within 2 years, the city of Springdale plans to have a new criminal justice complex in downtown. Officials broke ground on the project Friday afternoon. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda attended the ceremony, and she brings us this report.
Mayor Doug Sprouse says this is going to be a great project for the city.
This is a huge, huge deal for us. It's a big deal for our city. It's a big deal for the residents of our city.
He says it's a big deal for public safety and the police department, who has run out of space in its current location.
We had known for many years that we needed to find a way to make room for city operations and to be more convenient to our residents. When the current facility was built in the mid-90s, Springdale was much less than half the size it is now. And so obviously as our city has grown, we've been challenged. If I had to pinpoint, we've all been challenged in City Hall with space, but probably no one more than the police department.
The new criminal justice complex is being constructed next to the current city hall. Construction of the 125,000-square-foot building is estimated at around $35.5 million. The project is being funded by the 2018 bond issue that was passed by Springdale residents.
When it came time to expand City Hall and to build a new police department, you didn't have the debate in Springdale about where to put it. We knew it was going to be downtown. And that's where we want to be. That's where we need to be. And I'm thankful that the residents of Springdale and the voters of Springdale supported that and supported it strongly. This ballot issue passed by 80%, 80-20.
The city also received an approximately $3 million grant through the Walton Family Foundation's Northwest Arkansas Design Excellence Program. The building was designed by Duval Decker Architects, who are based in Jackson, Mississippi. Roy Decker with Duval Decker says the architecture of the building will be simple and it will be constructed from durable materials that will last a long time.
It takes its cues from the buildings that are here, the Shiloh Meeting Hall, the Chamber of Commerce building. It doesn't look to the past.
Instead, he says, it takes those roots and looks toward the future. The plan, Mayor Doug Sprouse says, is to complete the project in two parts.
Phase one will be the construction of the new police department, the new courts facilities, and Judge Harper's here, by the way, and our new city attorney's suites and offices area.
That's expected to take about a year. Phase two will be the renovation of the current city hall.
Then those departments will move into the new facility. The existing departments that are still using the current city hall will move to other buildings on Spring Street for the most part. And then the renovation of the existing city hall will take about a year. So we are looking at about a two-year process if everything rolls the way we hope it does.
Mayor Sprouse says the project will increase efficiency for residents by placing city services in one location instead of having them spread out through downtown.
I grew up here. I couldn't live in a better place. And we are so blessed to be here in Springdale. We're blessed to be in Northwest Arkansas. But for me, we're so excited about Springdale's future. And we're proud of our past and we're excited about our future.
The project also includes the purchase of some land to make room for parking. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large. Readers can become quite devoted to favorite writers. And for the most devoted, there can be a disappointment in completing a writer's canon and then a search for more. Fans of Donald Harrington can rejoice. The Arkansas-born author's work includes Architecture of the Arkansas Ozarks, Lightning Bug, and Milkweed. Most of his novels take place in or around the fictional hamlet of Staymore, nestled in the magical realism of the Ozarks. Fans of Harrington, and they can be about as devoted as any writer's followers, can read essays and book reviews by Donald Harrington and read interviews conducted with the author in his Fayetteville home. All of this in the new book, The Guest Room Novelist, a Donald Harrington miscellany, edited by Brian Walter and published by the University of Arkansas Press. Brian Walter is a professor of English at St. Louis College of Pharmacy and director of documentaries about Harrington. He joins me on the phone now. Brian Walter, welcome to Ozarks at Large.
Thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure.
Well, thank you. I have to, as an unabashed fan of Donald Harrington's work myself, I'm interested in how someone first encounters the works of Donald Harrington, so I'm going to begin our conversation that way. How did you first come across Donald Harrington?
So back in the mid-90s, when I was finishing my dissertation on Vladimir Nabokov, who is quite possibly, arguably, Don's favorite writer, or was his favorite writer, I subscribed to something called Nabokovel, the Vladimir Nabokov electronic discussion forum. And Don had donated or allowed to be published the first five or six chapters of his then newish novel, Yekaterina, which is kind of his homage to Nabokov. So I had heard about him then. He also carried on a dialogue with another novelist about Nabokov's influence on their work. But I'm mortified to say that after reading those first five or six chapters of Yekaterina, while I was still in St. Louis finishing up my dissertation, I didn't really pursue the matter further. But improbably enough, or maybe Don would say no, it's the fate thing at work for both of us. The one job offer I ended up with coming out of graduate school was at the University of the Ozarks in Clarksville. And so I ended up doing some book reviews, which he'd been doing for years at the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. And one of mine appeared with my byline from University of Ozarks and kind of went from there. He contacted me after seeing them.
In The Guest Room Novelist, a Donald Harrington miscellany, edited by Brian Walter, you include some of Donald's book reviews that were in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. And there does seem to be that sort of blending there. You can see Harrington, the novelist, in some of these reviews, but there's also something different happening in his writing, it seems to me. Did that come across to you as well?
Yes, absolutely. You know, he was somebody who prided himself certainly on his identity as a novelist, but he was also, of course, an art history professor and a writer, a scholar, and somebody who took his role as a public intellectual quite seriously, as an educated person who appreciated both the benefits of academia and academic preparation for things, but also somebody who was firmly planted in the world of Arkansas and the world of the Ozarks. And so he wanted to combine the two in the way that he wrote his reviews. He did that as well in his novels, but there's a little bit more of a sense of the professor, I think, in his reviews, who wants to share his enthusiasms and his frustrations or his kind of critiques with people because they mattered enormously to him. And so there's a little bit of a didact, I would say, or a didactic element to the reviews that probably isn't there in the novels.
But there's also a deep generosity. I'm thinking about his review that you include in this book, Black House, written by Stephen King and Peter Straub. And he spends the first three or four paragraphs explaining why you should not dismiss these popular writers.
Absolutely. He was a great friend of Peter Straub and a great admirer of Stephen King's. And that mattered enormously to him because, of course, the theme of underappreciation, in part because his novels were kind of associated with hillbilly culture, was hugely important to him. And so when you look at the two things, when I say that he was the professor and the didact who had things he wanted to teach people, that's part of what he wanted to teach them was appreciation for those who were pouring love and life into their works, but who were not necessarily getting the attention that others might. They might be taken a little bit less seriously when he saw certainly the depth, the verb, the vitality of the things that they were creating.
You know, there's a famous quote from a review of Harrington's work that called him an undiscovered continent. And we've seen that used in blurbs all over the place. And there was sort of a, among Donald Harrington fans, especially I think those in the Ozarks in Arkansas, this sort of wonder why he didn't achieve more widespread acknowledgement across the country. And I wonder, you know, if in your interviews, that conversation ever took place.
Yeah, to some degree. By the time that I met Don in the mid-90s and then was interviewing him for what turned out to be the documentaries in the book, you know, I wouldn't say he'd made peace with it exactly, but he'd certainly moved on from some of the tempests that he had waged and raged through, I think, when he was a younger novelist in the 60s and 70s over just this question. I think from his own perspective, it was fairly clear. He was being dismissed as a regionalist writer, or at least being treated as merely a regionalist writer. And all the worse, the region was the hillbilly Ozarks. And so because of that, it was too easy to miss the kind of remarkable aesthetic sophistication that he built into his books. Nothing that requires any extra effort on the reader's part to enjoy or to work through, but which will reward kind of scholarly and serious critical attention for anybody who spends time with them. So, yeah, that was very much a theme. You know, I was recently at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville working in special collections with some of his correspondents from the early 70s for this next volume that I'm working on for the University Press. And I got to see a little bit more of the tempest and the frustrations by looking at some of the correspondence from that relatively early period in his career, where he was certain, he was absolutely certain from various things with his publisher and his agent, that he was just about ready finally to get to leave his day job teaching art history, that he was going to become a novelist full time, that he was going to enjoy the kind of success that his contemporaries like John Irving and Cormac McCarthy were enjoying in their early career. And, you know, it's kind of a bromide. I've heard this in sports, for example, in the recent NBA finals. Somebody was saying you have to get a little bit lucky. You know, some teams just get injured at the wrong moment. And when it comes to, I think, becoming a best-selling, widely known author, it's not just quality often in the kind of fickle marketplace. It's also a little bit of timing and luck. And Don had unfortunate luck. I could tell you stories about stuff that happened with his publishers during the 70s and his agents that just right when he was always seemed to be on the brink of breaking out into widespread recognition, something happened that was just kind of catastrophic that he couldn't control that really kind of helped to limit the profile of his work.
Yeah, there was the movie that was more or less made, you know, inspired based on some other place, The Right Place. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't aware of Donald Harrington at that time, but talking to people who were and who knew him in Fayetteville thought, okay, that was going to be the launching point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was not the first one. Actually, the author of, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Roald Dahl, took a huge liking to Don's second published novel, Lightning Bug, which came out in 1970, and wrote a screenplay for it. And the people were kind of raving about it, and his publisher ordered a whole bunch of extra copies. It got a wonderful review in Time, and it just didn't sell. So that kind of went back and forth. Don changed agents around that time, and the agent that he moved to was somebody who worked with a lot of big names. I think I'm going to remember their names. Joseph Heller, I think, was one of them, maybe. And things didn't work out well with her. Don eventually wrote his own screenplay to Lightning Bug, but it just seems to have been lost in the shuffle, and nothing ever happened with it. So the one film that did get made, you just mentioned, it's called Return, and it was directed by Andrew Silver, and it came out in the 80s. And it was one of the first things, actually, when I, my first several visits of Don, we watched the film. And both he and his wife, Kim, were diplomatic about it, but they were willing to say, you know, it was not very successful, didn't evoke much of the book. And it certainly did not have great success at the box office or in the home video. So,
yeah, I'm speaking with Brian Walter. He's the editor of the new book, The Guest Room Novelist, A Donald Harrington Miscellany, published by the University of Arkansas Press. You mentioned that frustration and tempest, and that's reflected in the title essay, The Guest Room Novelist, which he, I think, originally delivered as a sort of an address and thought then it would get published somewhere else, and he had frustration getting that published.
Absolutely. That's another microcosm of his career. It's such a lovely essay, as you mentioned, his generosity in that essay. I think it comes through many entries in the book, but nowhere more so than in the title essay. And, you know, it's one of the things I was very pleased to be able to get that into print, because it's a perfect example of the way that Don was able to write about other people, other work, to do so thoughtfully, generously, and critically, but at the same time to embed an image of himself and his own work and his own frustrations and his own joys. It's an essay that looks in two directions, both outward and inward.
Is that widespread appeal possible? We might have a forest for the trees sort of approach to his novels. Mm-hmm. Can someone, do you think, in, I don't know, Nova Scotia or Gdansk or Santa Fe pick up Donald Harrington's novels and be as enthralled as we are?
I would certainly think so. I would hope so. I have been contacted by Harrington fans from certainly all over the country. He has, and actually even a few from overseas, some in the UK and others, who are great devotees of Harrington and Staymore. Part of it is the way that he roots his depiction of the physical world of Staymore and the Ozarks in the joys of language and colloquial speech and folk culture, which is, that is an absolutely timeless theme. You know, I've heard him described not just as the Faulkner of the Ozarks, or as I like to call him, the Nabokov of the Ozarks, but also you could argue he's the Chaucer of the Ozarks, or the Thomas Hardy of the Ozarks, somebody who is deeply interested in the way that folk speech, colloquial speech, reveals all sorts of aspects of culture at large, the way that people kind of connected with the environment that they chose to live in, to make home, and to reveal kind of the deep structures that underlie the whole idea of human community and human connection within that. So yeah, I think anybody who appreciates the connections between language and culture, and also, of course, anybody who appreciates a comic and comedic sensibility, which runs through all of Don's work, even when it's treating very, very serious storylines, certainly there's no reason you couldn't fall in love with the Staymore novels.
There will be a sequel of sorts that you're working on now?
That's the plan. We actually, the original version of Guest, as I usually refer to it, was to include some previous unpublished or uncollected fiction. And the original manuscript that I submitted was, it was over 500 pages with the fiction in it. And so the director of the press, Mike Beaker, said, you know, we want to make sure this is something pleasant and attractive and, you know, not too weighty, something that's nice to hold in hand. So what would you think about splitting it off? I said, yeah, that's pretty easy to do. Because it's not only going to include some short fiction, probably about half a dozen stories, but also a novella that I discovered by accident that he wrote in the early 70s called Double Toil and Trouble. And that's what, in fact, I was working on when you called. I'm just starting to get working on it. It's a curious little work. And when I was in Fayetteville a few weeks ago, this is part of what I was doing, special collection. The main thing was to try to find out the backstory of this mystery novella his widow, Kim, had never heard of either.
Oh, my.
So I found it by accident. And so it's kind of, it's a mystery novel in two senses. One, it's not clear how it happened. And now I have a little more of the backstory. But two, it's kind of a Staymore mystery. It involves a woman who goes to Staymore with two coffins that are mysteriously marked, and she needs to get help getting there because the train, there was not a foot of train track kind of laid in Newton County, apparently. Don was always pleased to point that out. So she has to get help from somebody in an adjacent county to take her to Staymore in a mule-drawn wagon or a horse-drawn wagon. And the question of who's in the coffins and how they came to die kind of runs through this short novel. And that will be kind of centerpiece of the follow-up volume, along with some other stories, as I mentioned.
And is it completed?
Yes. Yeah. So the quick backstory is the editor that he switched to after Lightning Bug's disappointment was a guy named Louis Howland. His name technically was Llewellyn Howland III, but he went by Louis. And he had loved Lightning Bug and then loved Some Other Place and published it. And between Some Other Place and The Architecture of the Arkansas Ozarks, there's a lot of correspondence between Louis Howland and Don, and then Louis Howland's first reader, a guy named Dick McDonough, to whom this novella, Double Toil and Trouble, is actually dedicated. And Louis Howland apparently asked Don, can you please write something really Hollywood-friendly, short, snappy, interesting, you know, not quite so dipped in folk culture, perhaps, but set in Staymore for me. And so Don, okay, and wow. Somehow up and wrote this novella in a matter of a few months, I think about early 1973, while working on Architecture of the Arkansas Ozarks, which ended up being published in 75, another, you know, huge book, the Bible of Staymore, as it's called. And so, but they never pursued it. Architecture of the Arkansas Ozarks was the last book he published with Louis Howland because of ruptures in both his and Howland's life, and then the disappointment of Some Other Place, The Right Place, and Architecture's relatively meager sales. They just never pursued Double Toil and Trouble. So it's a chapter of the Staymore saga that's never been told, never seen the light of day before, but it's going to be the centerpiece of this follow-up volume.
Brian Walter is the editor of the new book, The Guest Room Novelist, A Donald Harrington Miscellany, published by the University of Arkansas Press. He is a professor of English at St. Louis College of Pharmacy and director of Staymore, The World of Donald Harrington, and Farther Along, The World of Donald Harrington Part 2. He spoke with us via phone from St. Louis. Brian, thank you so much for your time.
It's been a great pleasure.
The 9th annual Winslow Half Marathon and 5K Run is Saturday, September 21st. This run through the Boston Mountains of Northwest Arkansas will end at the Winslow Community Expo Center with music, food, and local vendors. Registration and more information available at winslowrun.com. The Botanical Garden of the Ozarks welcomes terrific Tuesday nights. Now through August, the garden will be open for free from 5 to 8 p.m. each Tuesday. A variety of programs, including family-friendly concerts, will be offered on select evenings. Additional information available at bgozarks.org.
Ahead on today's show, one of the performers at our Summer Night Swing, Jesse Dean, gives us a preview of what he might do Friday night at the Fayetteville Public Library. That's just ahead. After launching several projects in Bentonville, like the Press Room, the Preacher's Son, the Record, and the Holler, the Rope Swing Hospitality Group is coming to Springdale. The company's managing director, Rob Apple, made the announcement at last week's Invest Springdale Summit that was held at the Apollo Theater on Emma Avenue.
This is where I want to stop for a moment, because the Holler is it was a fun project, but it was a bit of an experiment for us. We wanted to know what would happen if you deconstructed a restaurant a bit and let people choose an architecture when they walked in.
The Holler, which is part of the 8th Street Market, includes a play space with several shuffleboard courts, coffee and liquor bars, as well as food.
And we are very eager to do that in Springdale. So we're going to be bringing a hangout concept to Springdale, which we're calling Traveling Public.
The traveling public will be the anchor of what many residents refer to as the old Ryan's building on the corner of Emma and Commercial. Brenda Anderson of the Blue Crane Development Group says they're preserving the outside of the building.
The remainder of the building, the first floor, will be commercial tenant space. We'll be recruiting tenants to that space. And then above that, we'll have a four-story stack that will include 48 apartment units. We believe very strongly that people need to live in downtown, not just visit downtown, but live in downtown.
The Rope Swing Group and Blue Crane Development both have ties to Runway Group, which has ties to the Walton family. Construction on the project is expected to start later this year with an opening in early 2021. Another group called Shiloh Capital announced it's developing another mixed-use residential space on Emma Avenue, just west of the old Washington Elementary School building near the Jones Center. That project will include 24 apartment units that could open as early as 2020. During the summit, plans were also unveiled for Luther George Park. Those plans include access to the creek and an open-air stage. Attendees also saw drawings for a concept called Mile 13, referring to the 13th mile of the Razorback Greenway. It includes a redesign of the crossing at Shiloh Square and the creation of green gathering spaces. A new business announcement was also part of the day's presentations. Tyler Christopher, the executive vice president of Skipstone Pictures, says the film company is moving to Springdale.
Everything that we need, all the resources that we need are right here in this community. The only thing we don't have is oceanfront. So I'm the director of development, so whenever I get a script to approve and it takes place on an ocean, it now takes place on a lake. You want to make your movie? It's not going to be on an ocean. It's going to be on a lake. Beaver Lake, somewhere around there.
Skipstone Pictures has already filmed and produced family-friendly movies like Freddy and Max Winslow in the House of Secrets in Northwest Arkansas. Christopher says their next project is a musical production.
We move very fast. Our shoots are anywhere between 13 and 18 days to shoot an entire movie, right? And the musical is taking 18 days only because it's a musical. And we work 12 to 15 hours a day, 6 days a week for those 18 days.
Christopher says the new film project will include students studying dance and music at the University of Arkansas as part of the cast.
KUAF is raising money this June because the end of our financial year is at the end of this month. And why is that so important? Well, by ending our financial year strong, we're able to plan for the next year knowing we can continue to bring you the news, music, and conversations you've come to rely on. We need to prepare to cover breaking stories, to investigate unfolding stories, and cover the day's events. This coverage demands more resources than ever, but KUAF is committed to bringing you the highest quality programming, from the community spotlight to Ozarks at Large, every single day. Your support is what makes this possible. Make your gift right now, before June 30th, to keep this essential programming on your radio into 2020 and beyond. Give right now at supportkuaf.com.
Oh, and with me inside the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio for a quick update is Lee Wood with KUAF. She is the general manager in waiting, membership director now, and is helping us put together Friday Night Summer Night Swing. You're a busy person.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, Summer Night Swing is at the Fayetteville Public Library Friday night from 7 until
9.
Buddy Shoot and the Motivators will be there. Jesse Dean will be there. It's celebrating Paul Kelso and the Generic Blue Show. This is part of a greater end of fiscal year fundraiser at KUAF.
That's a mouthful. You did a very good job.
Thank you.
Thanks. No, you're absolutely right. We've been raising money most of June to end our fiscal year strong. We can end our budget knowing that we can plan for the next year and continue to bring all of the programming, local and national, that we all rely on and enjoy every single day. And we wanted to celebrate. Summer Night Swing is a great celebration, local music programs. And like you said, we're celebrating the Generic Blues Show. Tickets are still available, although we're limited. So I don't have an exact count right now. But if you would like to go to this concert, you should probably go and make a donation right now at supportkuaf.com and request one.
The goal was by the end of this month, June 30th, which is the end of our fiscal year, to raise $30,000 this month. That puts us in great shape at the end of the fiscal year. There's a $12,000 anonymous matching gift that kicks in. When we have raised $12,000, where are we with that?
We are $11,005.
So we need $995 to kick in.
To meet that challenge. So we're very close.
And when we do that, we're at $24,000.
Yes.
And then we're just, okay.
Yeah. So the $30,000 is in sight. So it's good. We've been, you know, fundraising and pushing, and you've been hearing community voices and NPR voices and local voices reminding you of how public radio works, and that it's your support and the support of fellow listeners that help pay for our bills. And now we're so close to meeting that challenge. And as you said, as soon as we are able to get the 995.
Yep, 995.
Then, yes, we can throw another $12,000 on our goal.
All right. And you can make a contribution. And if you like, make a contribution of $50 or more for a ticket to the Summer Night Swing. Limited tickets available for that. That's at supportkuaf.com.
That's correct. And I guess we should also remind everyone, because there's lots of people and it's busy and you may not live close by, you can listen to the live concert. It will be broadcast live this Friday evening, 7 to 9 p.m.
And one of the performers Friday night at Fayetteville Public Library, Jesse Dean, he stopped by the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio last week. Well, let's talk first about who you're going to be playing with. You know, Buddy.
I do know Buddy. I've never had the privilege of hearing him play, though, so I'm actually excited to be able to do that, finally.
Is that something that happens with musicians, is that you don't get a chance to hear each other play a lot because you're playing at the same time?
It's common. You know, if we're all working at the same time, it's hard to be there.
Kind of a good problem to have. You're playing so much.
I'd say it's good to be busy.
Yeah. Do you think about set lists at all ahead of time, or do you let it sort of naturally come?
Usually natural is the best way. Sometimes we have set lists depending on the nature of the concert, but generally we're flying by the seat of our pants.
Does that mean, let's say you're flying by the seat of your pants, do you know what the first song is going to be? Or
I have a handful of songs that I will always choose from for the first, just to break the ice, you know.
And go from there.
Yeah.
So we're going to be celebrating Paul Kelso and the Generic Blues Show, local stuff. And this is a celebration of local music, not just a local music show, but local music. Do you get a sense that this is a good place for local musicians?
Definitely.
Audiences are good.
This whole area, Northwest Arkansas, has a fabulous music scene, and it continues to grow every day.
I know that you mentioned that you don't get a chance to see some other people perform. You've never seen Buddy Shute perform. What can you get as an audience member when you do have a chance to see someone else perform?
Everything influences me. Everything I see, everything I hear, feel, touch, smell, you know. So it's nice to see what other people are doing. Nice to see how other people react to other, you know, it's just it's a learning curve for me, I would say. And I enjoy listening to live music. I don't get to do that very often, so.
Is there ever the danger? I'll admit that I can have this challenge if, say, I listen to a podcast that's telling a really good story and doing something that I do, and I think, oh, wow, they're doing that really well. Maybe, you know, I can learn something from that, but there's a tinge of jealousy, or is that ever an experience with you?
No, it just kind of leads me down the road and teaches me what I need to adjust. And how I should be progressing, I believe.
I imagine there are going to be some people there who've never seen you, never heard you. What's the you know, shorthand sketch of what they're going to hear and experience?
This time I'll be doing a solo show, so I'll probably do a lot of sort of ragtime style finger picking and a lot of my original music.
Thanks for coming in. And we'll see you Friday night.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kyle. See you next time.
Oh, where can people learn more about you?
JesseDeanRocks.com. And then my Facebook page always has the current events.
Jesse Dean is part of the Summer Night Swing that will take place Friday night at the Fayetteville Public Library. You can hear his performance live on the air on 91.3 Friday night, beginning at 7.
What did the VIMS instrument do? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science. And this is Scratching the Surface. So how do we know what chemical compounds and ices are at Saturn? We used the VIMS instrument from the Cassini orbiter. VIMS was the visible and infrared mapping spectrometer. It has three main groups for observing chemicals, each represented by a different wavelength and color. Compounds such as water ice, methane, nitrogen, ammonia, acetylene, and other chemicals each have their own wavelength fingerprint. So each chemical and ice compound fingerprint then reflects a different color according to the VIMS instrument. So these are 2 micron wavelengths, which is red colored, 2.8 micron wavelengths, which is blue, and 5 micron wavelengths, which is green. So for example, water ice would look more blue, and methane and organics would appear more green. VIMS has helped us discover that Saturn's rings are actually not all made up of the same stuff, but rather very paper-thin layers of different ices and rock and gases. For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, or for more segments of Scratching the Surface, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface with Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is a production of 91.3 FM KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas.
It's Monday. It's June 24th. With me in the Carver Center for Public Radio is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. How are you?
I'm thinking. I think I'm all right.
I have a theory.
What is that?
Mondays are better in summer.
Oh, yeah.
They don't feel quite like a full Monday.
No, they don't. You're right. I lived just off campus for 20 plus years. I always think that summer is directly tied to not feeling all the kids on campus.
Well, I think I speak for a lot of people have this feeling if you live in Fayetteville or any college town. I'm always ready for the bustle to end when it does in May, but I always get a big pick-me-up when the bustle begins again in August and September.
Exactly. I miss living right off campus.
Yeah.
I really do. And it's hard to set your internal clock. When you live there for so long, if you don't pay attention to that, your internal calendar's all messed
up. Yeah.
Now that I'm back in Fayetteville at an office in Fayetteville, my internal calendar's working much better now, thank you. My internal calendar says you should go to Fort Smith.
Why should we go to Fort Smith?
Because there's this really cool exhibit at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum. It's an artist that many of our listeners will have heard of, actually a photographer, Edward Robison from Eureka Springs. You know, most art mediums are art mediums. Oil paint is oil paint is oil paint. Well, if you're a photographer,
you can do all sorts of things.
Not the same at all. He started out printing in the darkroom using a 4x5 film camera. Now he's doing augmented reality. It's just hard for me to wrap my head around. He says that when he started as a professional photographer trying to make his living as an art photographer, the first iPhone was just coming out. No one took the potential of its camera seriously.
Right.
5 years ago, he thought that the augmented reality thing was way in the future. He said if he had to guess, 5 years from now, he'll either be doing something he can't even conceive of yet, or he'll have gone back to printing black and white photos. He's a great guy. He grew up outside of Warrensburg, Missouri, went to the University of Kansas, found out their only photography major was journalistic photography. He said, I don't really want to shoot people. Ended up at the Kansas City Art Institute, worked for the Nelson Atkins Museum, and then finally wound up in Eureka Springs. And interestingly enough, when he was working at the Nelson Atkins, he knew Lou Maluso, who was the director of the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum. So when Lou was trying to fill, when he came to the museum, he got part of an exhibition series. When he was trying to fill out the rest of that exhibition series, he realized Edward was in Eureka Springs and went, I'll call him.
There you go.
So you can actually download an app So you can click on his photographs and see the magic Harry Potter photos where they move.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
So he's, most of his work is landscape. Mm-hmm. So you walk up and there's a beautiful photograph of a mountain peak and a stream and all of the things that you expect to see. But then you use this app and all of that goes into motion.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. When he was starting out in the darkroom, he couldn't imagine this.
No, and he's doing gaming stuff and stereoscopic 360 degree stuff. It's way over my head, but really amazing. And remember, we thought Harry Potter was fiction, too. His work is called The Nature of Photography from Traditional to Augmented Reality, and it's on exhibit through September 1st. Hours at the museum are 11 to 6, Tuesday through Saturday, 1 to 5 on Sunday, and their core collections are always free.
And you know what I love about this? It's connecting through the tunnel. It's Northwest Arkansas and the Fort Smith Metro.
Isn't that connected. Cool?
Yeah, I do like that.
And also this week, because this time of year is exhausting, tomorrow is Terrific Tuesday at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks from 5 to 8. It's free admission. See the garden.
And they have Terrific Tuesdays through most, if not all, of August.
And some of them have programs, and this one is just See the Garden. Opera in the Ozarks tomorrow night is La Boheme, 7:30 at Inspiration Point up by Eureka Springs. Tickets are $30 for adults. On Wednesday, it's Live at the Five and Dime series at 6 o'clock at the Walmart Museum in Bentonville. That's a UA jazz trio, and that's free. Artisphere is the romantic masterworks of Mendelssohn and Brahms with the Artisphere Festival Orchestra at 7 at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. That one's expensive. $10. Opera in the Ozarks that night is Little Women. On Thursday, it's the Gully Park Concert Series, which used to be all there was.
And who is it this week?
Northwest Arkansas Jazz and More Orchestra.
All right.
That starts at 7. There's food trucks and dogs and it's
Frisbees
all good.
And...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Artisphere that night is Off the Grid with the Artisphere Festival Orchestra at 7 in the Dixon Street Entertainment District.
Oh, yes.
It's a pop-up.
Yeah.
So you have to figure out where they popped up at. Opera in the Ozarks Thursday night is The Abduction from the Seraglio by Mozart. And then on Friday, it's Music on the Square in Kingston.
Who's performing on Friday?
Willie Carlisle is the opener.
That's awesome.
And Home by Daylight is the headliner. Right. That starts at 7. It's a beautiful drive out to Kingston. They usually have like an FFA group selling hot dogs.
Yeah.
And
it's a lot
just,
of fun. The drive there is beautiful. The drive back is beautiful.
They actually have like a bandstand in the middle of the square. It's just perfect. And Opera in the Ozarks that night is La Boheme again.
Thank you.
I don't know how you do it all.
Thank you, Becca.
Support for KUAF comes from the Walmart Museum, presenting Live at the Five and Dime Concert Series each Wednesday evening from 6 to 8 p.m. This series, in collaboration with the University of Arkansas Department of Music and Downtown Bentonville Incorporated, is located on the square in downtown Bentonville. WalmartMuseum.com under Events tab for more information. KUAF is giving away tickets to the 2019 Spaceberry Music Festival, July 4th through the 6th on the farm in Eureka Springs. This three-day jam and funk music festival welcomes Forgotten Space, Grateful Dead Tribute, Magic Beans, Arkansas, and others, plus camping, food, and craft vendors. Winners announced Friday, June 28th during Ozarks at Large. KUAF.com to register or for more information.
And those winners will be announced this Friday on Ozarks at Large. Tomorrow, on a Tuesday, Ozarks at Large, the Militant Grammarian takes us beyond nouns and verbs. Ozarks at Large, tomorrow at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs. Saturday, July 5th, 1975, began like most any other day in Fordyce, Arkansas on a lazy holiday weekend. By the end of the day, the Fordyce restaurant and station in Dallas County would be on the lips of broadcasters around the globe, and the South Arkansas town would become a footnote in the police record of the self-proclaimed world's greatest rock and roll band, the Rolling Stones. By the early 21st century, the notion of the Rolling Stones being dangerous is laughable, but an outlaw image was cultivated from the British quintet's inception in the early 1960s. Then, the Stones played mostly blues from the Arkansas and Mississippi deltas, but even as their music changed, the image, at least through the mid-1970s, stuck. Arkansas native Bill Carter was the Rolling Stones' lawyer from 1973 to 1983, and according to him, in 1975, everywhere the Stones went, it was a challenge to the authorities. Riot squads, narcotics units, and drug dogs were common during the 28-city tour. The Rolling Stones have a few sometimes tenuous Arkansas connections besides their aforementioned Arkansas lawyer. Little Rock native Jim Dickinson plays piano on Wild Horses, heard earlier. Probably the most lauded of all Rolling Stones albums, 1971's Exile on Main Street has a song that mentions Little Rock, Rip This Joint, heard here. And then there's all the Arkansas-related musicians that influenced the Stones, like Howlin' Wolf and Robert Johnson. Then, there's the July 5th, 1975 visit and subsequent arrest of guitarist Ron Wood and Keith Richards in Fort Ice, Arkansas. On Friday, the 4th of July, the Rolling Stones performed at Memphis and were scheduled to play in Dallas on Sunday. There'd been a stormy flight 2 days earlier from Washington, D.C. to Memphis. The band were in the cradle of the music they loved and in the homeland of their idols. Keith Richards and the new member of the group, Ron Wood, decided to drive to Dallas and take in the sights with two friends from their entourage. Several hours later, the four, driving a rented yellow 1975 Chevy Impala, found themselves lunching at the Fordyce Restaurant and Station in Fordyce. Making a play on the name of the town, the building features four tumbling dice painted on its front. Two of the group, including Ronnie Wood, hit the all-you-can-eat buffet at the Fordyce. Wood went back for seconds on the fried chicken. Keith Richards, meanwhile, ordered the 16-ounce T-bone and had brown gravy over his French fries on the recommendation of the waitress. About 3 p.m., the group left the Fordyce Restaurant and Station for the Impala, leaving behind a $1.65 tip and some autographs. Soon after leaving, the yellow car with Keith Richards at the wheel was pulled over for reckless driving. From here, the details are less clear. Stories differ by a few miles where the car was pulled over and whether the reckless driving happened before or after lunch. Richards was also cited for carrying an illegal weapon, a hunting knife. The four were taken to Fordyce City Jail and the car was impounded. A search warrant was granted since an officer said he smelled marijuana smoke. Fordyce police didn't find pot, but did find less than 2 grams of cocaine in a briefcase, said to belong to one of the non-Stones along for the ride. Keith Richards was given and passed a sobriety test. Fordyce Mayor William Lyon remembers the scene this way.
Well, in the town of 5,000, the Rolling Stones are big time stuff, boy. Everyone does remember it. It was a shock, really, to the town that they were down at the City Hall and in jail and being charged when it first came out. And so the whole town kind of went down to see about it, maybe see them or see what the deal was, and the town will never forget it.
Word of the arrest of the guitarist quickly spread. An ever-growing number of fans gathered outside Fordyce City Hall that night. By the end of the evening, the crowd was said to number in the hundreds. The news was carried around the world. Inside, the group drank soda, and Ron Wood rode a confiscated bicycle around the halls. Keith Richards swore the Rolling Stones would never play in Arkansas. They didn't spend any time behind bars. Before midnight, thanks to their Arkansas lawyer, the group was released on bond. The international tour of the Rolling Stones, which grossed $13 million in 1975, was back on track when lead guitarist Keith Richards posted a bond of $162.50 to Fordyce City Hall. He was scheduled to appear in Fordyce Court on August 1st, but forfeited his bond. Despite the alleged vow never to play Arkansas, on November 11, 1994, the Rolling Stones Voodoo Lounge Tour came to War Memorial Stadium in Little Rock. Although some residents of South Arkansas apparently think differently, the Rolling Stones never overtly mentioned the Fordyce incident in song. Bassist Bill Wyman, who wasn't there, mentions the arrest briefly in his 1992 autobiography, calling it a tough baptism for new member Ron Wood. From 1978, however, is a song that could allude to Ron Wood and Keith Richards' Arkansas arrest, Before They Make Me Run, sung by Keith. From 1978 is the Rolling Stones with Before They Make Me Run, sung by Keith Richards. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs, since 1998.
And contributors to today's Ozarks at Large included Antoinette Grajeda and Zuzana Sitek. Zuzana brought us details about the latest plans for downtown Springdale. Timothy Dennis mastered our show today. Thanks as well to Becca Martin-Brown for giving us a heads up on what's happening this weekend. She does that every day in the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Our appreciation, too, to Lee Wood for the fundraising update. This reminder, you can always contribute to your public radio station at supportkuaf.com. Arkansongs is produced in Little Rock, and it comes to us through our partnership with KUAR, Public Radio for Central Arkansas and Little Rock. Scratching the Surface is written and hosted by Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager at the University of Arkansas. It's produced in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio by Pete Hartman. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. You can always find out much more about us and listen to past editions of Ozarks at Large, as well as individual stories and interviews at ozarksatlarge.com. There, you'll also find links that allow you to share those interviews and stories with friends and family. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Chester. Thanks so much for spending part of your Monday with us. I'm Kyle Kellums. We will be back with another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow on KUAF. You can hear us at noon and 7 p.m. every Monday through Friday. Have a great rest of your Monday.